1982, he established and became dean of the Gallatin Division, the Interdisciplinary Studies and Great Books Program of New York University. He's professor of social studies at NYU and the director of the Visions of the Future program and the Center for Education and Employment Policy at the Hudson Institute. He received both his BA and his MA from Columbia University and his PhD from New York University. He has a distinguished publication record. Reading from the April 21st, 1989 edition of the National Review, there's an article entitled London in New York. It begins with the paragraph, Edward Coke, who has been mayor of New York longer than Margaret Thatcher has been prime minister of Great Britain, is seeking his fourth term. Given the ideological climate of the day in which the moderately liberal Coke appears as a kind of Jesse Helms, he may well fail to win the Democratic nomination, in which case he would run as an independent. The article goes on to discuss the three other candidates, particularly on the Republican side. Final paragraph says, Herb London, dean of the Gallatin Division of New York University, has come out against rent control and for school vouchers. He's a long shot for the Republican nomination and a longer shot for mayor. But in a city that has a glut of politicians and a dearth of ideas, he fills an important need. The city will profit from his candidacy, and the Republican Party would do itself honor by giving him its support. Lastly, reading from the December 12, 1988 edition of Insight, an article called The Right's Response to Radicalism, covering the meeting of the Conservative National Association of Scholars, the following paragraph is included. Against all this, the association regards itself as a kind of government in exile, carrying the torch for the highest value, in the words of Association Chairman Herbert I. London, Dean of the Gallatin Division of New York University. Balch described the kind of university his organization hoped to restore as a place conceived as a special haven of tolerance and civility, an open intellectual marketplace, and an unobstructed field for those single-minded about the pursuit of truth. Dr. London, please.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. This is very different from the kind of audiences I address in New York. When I talk about rent control in New York City, I usually face obscenities. When I am told that I am pro-choice, people think it's on abortion. When I tell them I am pro-life, people usually walk out of the room. When I do talk about schools, I always talk about my pro-choice attitudes and people leave the room. I hope people won't leave the room today, and I thank Don Lipset for inviting me, because this is, of course, a reprieve from the campaign season, and it gives me a chance to reflect on something near and dear to my heart, the state of academic life. I was impressed by the fact that Professor Allen talked about a course he gave called The Moral Fable, since I intend to talk about the traditional curriculum as fable. This conference, it seems to me, raises one of the most urgent questions in higher education. Is the decline reversible? And what I would regard as the significant corollary questions, what is an appropriate curriculum for our students, and what happened to the consensus on which the college curriculum once rested? It seems to me that the criticisms of Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind are symptomatic of the problem we are facing in the academy. High standards are described as elitism, a pejorative of scathing proportions. A call for the assertion of Western traditions has been described as racist and anti-democratic, and Bloom's critique of radical feminism as a virus let loose on the curriculum has been greeted with the cry, phallocentrism. The college curriculum is the source of youthful enlightenment free of the impediments of bias and prejudice have clearly unraveled. While Stanley Katz, president of the American Council of Learned Societies, recently noted that scholars are less politicized in the United States than any other country in the developed world, he neglected to point out the profound and revolutionary change that has occurred in American campuses since the 1960s that has resulted in the institutionalization of a radical agenda. even if one agrees with Dr. Katz or considers my description somewhat exaggerated. There are some conditions in higher education with which most serious scholars are likely to concur. One is that some matters should be studied by all students, and two is that the welfare of society depends on some knowledge and appreciation of basic ideas that undergird this democratic polity. These generalizations in themselves rarely cause a heated reaction, but their application in a society as diverse, perhaps atomistic as ours, makes them intrinsically volatile. William Bennett, in Our Children and Our Country, noted that there is no longer an overarching, well-understood purpose for the university. In the past, some distant, imprecise past, all activities were ancillary to teaching, including research and publication. Today, however, the purpose is manifold, including research, administration, publication, affirmative action programs, redressing real and perceived social ills, therapy for middle-class kids suffering from the ravages of divorce and neglect, ideological indoctrination, what I in another context have called the Derridaization of the curriculum, and occasionally teaching. The honored disciplines are still taught, and some are less contaminated by the political virus than others. But along with them is a heavy overlay of deconstruction, Lacanism, Marxism, semiotics, minimalism, hermeneutics of everything except the Bible, self and ethnic studies, and theory. Theory about every matter to which a theory can be applied. Let me illustrate this point with my fable, a Hasidic tale as described by Martin Buber. This story involves the consuming desire of Reb Yitzhak Yaakov to encounter the prophet Elijah. Elijah, according to the Bible, did not die. He was carried off to heaven in a fiery chariot, and ever since, Jewish tradition has it, he has regularly been sent on various missions through the world, under disguise, to hasten the coming of the Messiah. To satisfy his desire, Reb Yitzhak Yaakov, who lived in Poland, would himself put on a disguise, setting out with his companion in peasant's clothing, wandering the streets and markets of neighboring villages, hoping by chance or God's grace to meet the prophet Elijah. One day, as they were walking down a typically unpaved and sandy street, they met a peasant walking towards them, leading a donkey on a halter. Yitzhak grabbed his companion's arm in deep agitation. "There he is," he cried. But the peasant glared at him with fiery eyes. "Yehudi," he thundered. Yehudi means Jew. "Yehudi, if you know, why must you speak?" In an instant, Elijah disappeared. Now, as I see it, the passage of Elijah in this tale signifies the assurance Yitzhak so ardently desired, that a divine purpose exists and that it has been furthered. The meeting with Elijah is the dazzling sign that there is a latent meaning and a body of principles governing the world, which, to many, may seem devoid of both meaning and principle. But why, one might well ask, although Buber does not, was Elijah angry? Why did he disappear as soon as he was identified? And let me add a third question, which on first blush may seem rather frivolous. What happened to the donkey? I shall return to these questions in due course, but first I would like to ask why the curriculum consensus on our campus has unraveled. Some might be tempted to argue that the curriculum is a reflection of the disorder of our time, in which false and perverse notions are employed in order to exercise unchecked faculty authority or to enhance self-indulgent lives. Others argue the curriculum is a market unfettered by a transcendent idea of the good or even the desirable. In this view, the curriculum exists as a pork barrel, allowing trade-offs among departments, one philosophy course for one history course, and so on. Still another view has it that the curriculum is a social mirror, reflecting those ideas which are in fashion or which are seemingly in the ascendancy. Some critics of higher education contend that the curriculum is unbound by any sense of purpose and is merely a supermarket of courses. Clearly, it would be unwise to argue the curriculum should be narrowly sectarian. I'm reminded of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's response to a French ambassador who earnestly spoke of friendly relations between the two countries. Gaddafi nodded and then said, "Oh, it would be so much easier if the French were to convert to Islam." As professors, we are constrained by the reality of cultural, religious, and ethnic differences, which make an inflexible curriculum improbable. But that in no way obviates the need for a common bond that asserts the deposited wisdom of our civilization, that asks the essential questions of life. How should I live? What is the good life? What can I hope for? What must I do? How do I find the truth? Questions, I might ask, raised by Alan Bloom. And that provides students with knowledge of the democratic polity in which they are citizens. While we are all living in a durably enigmatic universe, following a path through life which in time leads each one of us to his death, we all want, or should want, to know what we are doing here, what we must do to serve this community, to give our lives value, and to overcome the paradox and the apparent derision of death, which it might seem threatens to deprive all our efforts, all our accomplishments, of lasting significance. Higher education in itself cannot address this yearning. At its best, it refines the questions and establishes a path for the pursuit of answers. Yet my concern is that the typical college curriculum does not ask the important questions, does not encourage the quest for real self and community knowledge, and substitutes the wisdom on which this civilization is founded for that which is current and evanescent. It is ironic that at the moment we have eviscerated meaning from the curriculum, academics have urgently called for something called values education, a phrase redolent on the pages of the Chronicle of Higher Education. But what is that values education to be? The emergence of cultural relativism has elicited the belief that our culture is one of many others, deserving no particular rejoicing or even attention. As the web of symbols which in every culture designates the ultimate values from which moral rules are derived is subject to rational exegesis and then recantation, a vacuum results which most high-minded scholars don't have the foggiest idea of how to fill. Moreover, the scientific worldview on which scholarly discourse depends provides only one dimension of values and by no means the most important dimension. This leaves us in a double bind. The call for values in the curriculum occurs in a social setting characterized by accelerated change, a scientific worldview, a skepticism towards religion, a fascination with that which is fashionable, and the emergence of a peculiar orthodoxy which relies on relativism except when it comes to women, blacks, and the third world. One cannot bring back the past, despite my wish, but neither can one forget the past. Well, there are obviously many ways to pursue curriculum reform and many viewpoints and directions to be taken. I would argue that the way toward the reassertion of common sense is in those questions that deal with our fundamental humanity. Instead of the compromise that has afflicted higher education since the 1960s, it seems to me a torch should be carried, like a government in exile, for the highest value, that which is irrefutably common to all students, the desire to know and the desire to question. We are all like Reb Yitzhak Yaakov, walking through the streets in search of a presence which will confirm our faith, our humanity, that will certify we are not adrift in an inhuman and meaningless universe, headed for a meaningless death. This is the common bond we share, and it is upon that search that the curriculum must be constructed. This brings me to another of my questions from the allegorical tale. Why was Elijah angry? He was angry, I contend, because while people may be allowed to sense his presence, they cannot presume to point it out and give it a name. The time was not yet ripe for revelation because in the Jewish tradition, the Messiah had not come, and the preparation for his coming made everything precarious. One does not designate this hidden force. One does not utter the name of God capriciously. There are good reasons for such things. Elijah disappeared because he was designated and named. Elijah said what should have been left unspoken and acknowledged only in the heart. If I may apply Yitzhak's dilemma to the academy, the highest value is potentially ripened within the world, within the walls of our colleges. The nostalgic need often expressed for a human world will only find its expression in the quest for what is most authentically human. That is not a quest limited by the last two decades or even the last two centuries. It is the pursuit of universal themes that transcend the latest cause or ism or go right to the essence of being human. The 19th century Polish poet Cyprian Norwood faced with a crude demand for a truth, saved his neck by replying, "Man is not yet ripe. He is a priest without knowing it." What I think he meant by that phrase is that, like Yitzhak, each of us is a questioner, a mediator between the highest value and the banality of quotidian responsibility, between a world that is drearily predictable and a future charged with possibilities. Those are the real parameters of curriculum decisions, not whether the voices of femininity, color, or the third world will be represented on a reading list, but whether those readings and questions bring us closer to the true source of our humanity. Now for the last of my questions. What happened to the donkey which Elijah was leading down the dusty village street? I suspect, since I don't have this from a higher authority, I suspect that when the prophet disappeared, the donkey ambled down the street and stopped at a water fountain. There he was picked up by a man who had witnessed the encounter and knew the donkey belonged to the prophet Elijah. Realizing the animal was endowed with special powers, he was sent to the United States, where he was given an endowed chair in semiotics at the University of California at Berkeley and is now a tenured professor. Well, Elijah in my story is the searing, unrelenting, illuminating questioner. The donkey is no more than the precarious and false answer. One might say the donkey is the golden calf, a firm answer to a question that requires no answering. Like so many subjects in the contemporary curriculum, there are questions that don't deserve our attention. For example, can peace be established through the elimination of nuclear weapons? Is race the only way to evaluate societies? Should hermeneutics be reduced to gender? I can obviously go on, and so can you. The essence of the curriculum is desire. The desire to go beyond oneself and to ask the questions that cut across time and place. The extent to which scholars can revisit the issue of the curriculum with this desire in mind is, it seems to me, the manner in which true educational attainment can be encouraged. This is the way to reverse the decline. I am not sanguine this will occur, but like my belief in Elijah, some matters are better left unsaid, and faith is still the great harbinger of change. Thank you very much for being so attentive.